Glory to thee, O God, glory to thee, O heavenly King, comforter, the spirit of truth, who art everywhere present and fillest all things, treasury of good things and giver of life, come and abide in us, cleanse us from every stain, and save our souls, O good one. Lord, bless.
All right, welcome. We are on, officially, double digits when it comes to the number of catechisms. We are on catechism number 10 of 14, and so we're moving along pretty well. As I just mentioned, we'll go till December 18th, and so we'll just keep going until then, and that'll be the whole series. So, as always, we'll start with a little recap. Last week, we covered the topics of prayer, the saints, the Panagia, and icons. So we covered quite a bit in one talk. And of course, you probably remember, we spent the vast majority of the time on the topic of prayer. This is the foundation of the spiritual life. Prayer is the foundation. If you're not praying, the foundation will break through and everything else will fall apart. Saint Theophan the Recluse says, when our prayer life is good, everything is good. When our prayer life is bad, everything is bad. Outwardly, everything can remain the same. But when prayer life is good, you have peace and you can handle everything happening outside of yourself. When you don't have prayer, you don't have that peace and things will break you. This is where we run into a lot of problems. So people who fall away from the faith, they all start off the same way. They stop praying. They cease praying. And so we want to make sure that our prayer life is consistent. And we talked last week really with the main point about how prayer is a mystery. And when we participate in this mystery, we're purified, causing us to pray better. So prayer is one of those cases where quantity leads to quality. So if you feel like your prayer life isn't really helping you, the answer is pray more. You may run into some specific problems and specific issues and questions. That's fine. Come talk to me. Maybe I'll give you an answer. Maybe I'll point you to certain books that have good answers in them. But as long as we keep praying, eventually those rough patches kind of go away and it starts to flatten out and steady itself again. And you'll find that prayer life becomes really beautiful. We learn to love prayer by doing it. You can read some great books that are really going to inspire you in prayer, or some lives of saints that will really inspire you in prayer. But really, a long-lasting love of prayer happens when we do it. But this takes a lot of time and struggle. There's much blood, sweat, and tears that go into really learning to pray. But grace eventually breaks through the difficulties, and the holy encounter that prayer is makes the invisible glory of prayer overcome the outward struggles of time, energy, and focus. Those are the three real dangers to prayer, right? We feel like we don't have enough time. We feel like we don't have enough energy. We feel like we can't focus because we're too distracted by the things of this world. But as I told you last week, prayer can't just be one more thing to add to life. If that's all it is, if it's just one more box to check off, one more thing to do on the to-do list, then time, energy, and focus are going to get in the way. Prayer should be a refuge from the things that cause you stress with time, energy, and focus. And so if prayer is a true encounter with God, what you'll find is that you'll actually be looking forward to times of prayer. You'll learn to actually really learn to really love prayer, and you'll see prayer as an opportunity to take all the stress and the frustrations, the anxieties of life, and put them aside for a second and find real peace. And that peace will help you encounter those things much more fully. So beware of that temptation to see prayer as just one more thing on your list of to-do list items. It can't be that. It has to be a holy encounter with God, one in which you stand in awe before God, one in which you encounter the living God, and you invite him in to purify you. And in doing so, that purity actually brings you peace and joy, and it becomes a refuge from the rest of life's turmoil. Life is where turmoil is. Prayer is where peace is. But in order to find that peace, we have to find the turmoil of prayer, which is spiritual warfare. And so that warfare will come. It'll be difficult, but push through. Just trust me in this. Push through. So, our foundation in the spiritual life is indeed prayer, but it's something else as well. Because the foundation is made of brick and mortar. And the bricks are prayer. The mortar is fasting. That's the main topic we're going to discuss today. Today we're going to discuss fasting, being an ecclesial being, I'll talk about what that means, how to act in the church, and then the church of the home. The main brunt of today is going to be talking about fasting. Okay? Fasting in the spiritual life can take a few different forms. There's really three different forms of fasting. The first is when we cut out particular types of food. We focus on just certain types of food eating. The second is when we completely fast from food and we only drink liquids. And the third is where we completely abstain wholly from food and drink. Those are the three different types of fasting that we do. The first type, fasting from particular kinds of foods, is the most common type of fasting in the church. Though complete absence of food and drink is asked of all Orthodox Christians before Holy Communion for at least 8 hours. So before we receive Holy Communion, we try to abstain from all food and drink for about 8 hours. Okay? At least 8 hours. You can do more than that, that's fine. You know, so don't, if you sit there and think, well, okay, communion's at 10 o'clock, and so I want to make sure that I eat at 2 a.m. No, just have your meal at night, go to bed, and forget it. Okay? You'll find in time that it's actually not a very difficult thing to do. And it becomes so normalized for you that when you skip breakfast, you don't even realize it. This happens in my life all the time. I mean, I almost never have breakfast. I've kind of forgotten about the meal of breakfast, but on a day off, maybe I'll have breakfast with my family. And if I miss it, it's just not a really big deal. You just kind of forget it and move on. Okay. Fasting is really a lost discipline outside of Orthodoxy. Throughout most of Christianity, we really don't hear a lot about fasting. The intellectualization of the faith, still getting over my cold, I'm still tired, intellectualization of the faith has caused fasting to be either downplayed and sometimes completely removed from the spiritual life. And it's almost always misunderstood. We really misunderstand what fasting is about. Fasting is best understood through practice. It's just like prayer. If you really want to understand prayer, you have to pray. I can talk to you about prayer, you can read books about prayer, but you won't really understand prayer, the struggle, and the blessing of prayer unless you pray. It's the same with fasting. The more we fast, the more we understand the power that fasting has. And power is the right word. Fasting has great power in the spiritual life. Fasting has always been a major part of the lives of righteous figures before God. Always. Right from the beginning, fasting has been a part of righteous lives. In the Old Testament, we see Moses fasting for 40 days and nights before receiving the tablets, the Ten Commandments, and then he repeats the same discipline, fasting 40 days and 40 nights in order to receive the tablets again after breaking them the first time. The Israelites made themselves unworthy of the blessing of the Ten Commandments, and so he shattered them, and he had to go and retrieve them again. And so what did he do? He fasted again for 40 days and 40 nights. Elijah also fasted 40 days and 40 nights before God visited him on Mount Horeb. We see Daniel fasting for 3 weeks. We see Hannah fasting and weeping and praying before giving birth to Samuel. We see the people of Nineveh literally turning away God's judgment. Through what? Through repentance, which included fasting. Fasting has great power. Fasting was prescribed before the Day of Atonement and many of the other feasts of the Old Testament. We could add many other verses and many other people's fasts from the Old Testament, the commandments of God to fast. The Old Testament is full of examples of fasting. In the New Testament, we know that Christ himself fasted for 40 days and 40 nights while being tempted in the desert by the devil. The apostles are mentioned a few times in Acts as coupling their prayer with fasting. It was a normalized practice in the Old Testament and for the apostles in the New Testament, such that you don't really see a lot of direct instruction about fasting because it was so normalized. It was a normalized part of life. Everyone knew that fasting was just part of the Christian life. There's one Protestant who disagrees with me. I read his commentary online just the other day, and he said, you know, the New Testament neither commands nor forbids Christians from fasting. And so really it's just a choice, you can fast or not fast. Not correct. This is not correct. We see directly in Matthew 9:15. Matthew 9:15, it says, "And Jesus said to them, 'Can the wedding guests mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them?'" So what's happening here? The Pharisees and the Sadducees are seeing that the disciples are plucking the heads of wheat And they're eating them, and they're saying, well, don't your disciples fast? Come on, shouldn't they be fasting? And this is his answer. He says, can the wedding guests mourn as long as the bridegroom is with them? In other words, fast is part of our repentance. But then he says this, the days will come when the bridegroom is taken away from them, and then they will fast. And then they will fast. The assumption that Christ had is that his followers would make fasting part of their spiritual lives. It was an assumption of Christ that his followers would fast. We see in the lives of the saints, the saints were masters, absolute masters when it came to prayer and fasting. There's a famous story of St. Pachomius the Great. He is one to whom an angel appeared, and the angel taught him the order of how to live as a monastic community. So there were people running into the deserts and being hermits and hermitesses, and they live in small communities, but the communities were very loose-knit. They really lived on their own. And an angel appeared to St. Pachomius and taught him how to create what was called a cenobitic monastery, which is how monasteries are today. They're cenobitic. You go to a monastery, like the men's group just did in California, and you see that they live in common. They have their own rooms, but otherwise they go to church in common. They have a common abbot. And so this angel appeared to St. Pachomius. St. Pachomius is incredibly holy, absolutely astounding saint. So St. Pachomius, by the time he dies, he has thousands of monks under his care. Thousands. I mean, it boggles the mind how successful he was. But he was so holy. And during one of the Lents, there was an argument that happened at the beginning of Lent between two monks. They were arguing over which asceticism was better, to not eat or drink at all for 40 days or to not sleep for 40 days for the 40 days of Lent. And St. Pachomius is brought into the middle of this. They're saying, you be the judge. You're the abbot. You're the one to teach us. You teach us. Which is better? Because, you know, I think I can go without eating. He thinks he can go without sleeping. Which one's better? And St. Pachomius just kind of sighed like, oh, gosh, you idiots. Like, you guys are arguing over this? This is ridiculous. And he walks over to a corner where there's an icon, and he stands and begins to pray. And he doesn't move for 40 days and 40 nights. He neither eats nor drinks nor sleeps and puts them to shame, puts them to utter shame. We see this. You may sit there and go, come on, that type of fasting, can that really happen? Well, Christ did it, and he was fully human. And we do see this in the lives of saints, where they fast for many, many weeks at a time. But in the most cases, what they'll do is they'll fast. The most extreme will eat only every other day, some of them every third day, or they'll only have one small meal per day, and they'll only have it after sunset. So they'll take fasting to these much higher and deeper levels than most of us are called to. But the saints show us that fasting absolutely is a vital and essential aspect of the spiritual life. And again, it's part of that foundation. If we want our prayer to take wings, it must take the wings of fasting. The church calls us to four main periods of fasting. There's four major periods. And so the fathers of the church understood that our life, our spiritual life, is going to go up and down. And sometimes we become more zealous, but we become a little bit more zealous than we can actually handle. And then we become a little more slack than we really should. And we're constantly trying to level off. And so it's the fathers are trying to constantly pull us upward and say, let's go a little bit higher. And so there's four periods in the year that are pretty evenly spaced in which we are called to major fasts. We're in one of those right now with the Nativity fast. It's 40 days of fasting, the Nativity. Then, of course, we have Great and Holy Lent. Great and Holy Lent is 40 days plus 2 days in a weekend, Lazarus Saturday and Palm Sunday, plus another 6 days of Holy Week. Okay, so 48 days total from Lent, the beginning of Lent, Clean Monday, until Holy Pascha or Easter. Okay, so in addition to we have the 40 days before, or the Nativity, we have the 48 days before Pascha. Then we have the Apostles' Fast. The Apostles' Fast is interesting because it takes place before we commemorate Saints Peter and Paul and then all the Holy Apostles the next day, June 29th and 30th. But it's interesting because the length of it depends on when Pascha falls. Pascha is what we call a movable feast. It's not always on the same day every year. And so if Pascha is really early, the Apostles' Fast could be as long as Lent. It could be 40 days. Or like this last year, if Pascha is rather late, the Apostles' Fast could be 1 day. And so it really depends on where Pascha falls. Now, you may sit there and go, ooh, one day, that sounds much better. We need fasting. We really need fasting, and you'll learn after some time that you'll actually really appreciate the fast and really love them, and when it's short like that, you're going to figure out that you may need to implement a stricter fast on yourself, because we really benefit from these fast periods. And then the final period is from August 1st through the 14th, and that's the Panagia fast. On August 15th is the dormition, or the falling asleep, of the Mother of God, and so we fast for 14 days before that, and we do the Paraklesis service basically every night before that, okay? So those are the four main fast periods. In addition to that, of course, we fast on Wednesdays and Fridays. Friday is the day that we commemorate the crucifixion of Christ. And so every Friday, because he was crucified on a Friday, we bring that to mind. We should fast consciously, really bring into mind why we're fasting. Why do we not eat meat and dairy, wine, oil on a Friday? Because we're lamenting, we're repenting for the fact that our sins crucified our Lord. And then on Wednesday is the day that Judas decided to betray Christ. And so we commemorate that. We commemorate the fact that every sin of ours is a betrayal of Christ. And we seek not to do that. So we fast Wednesdays and Fridays. Monastics will fast also on Mondays. So monks and nuns will fast on Mondays in commemoration of the angels. Because one third of the angels fell and became demons. And so in order to become like the new angelic rank, to repopulate it, they'll fast on Mondays as well. Okay, so that's not required of the laity, but monastics will fast then. Monastics, by the way, typically don't eat meat at all. So when they fast, it's just from dairy, wine, and oil. They don't eat meat at all in order to become paradisical, to become like we were in paradise when there was no eating of animals. Okay? A typical fast, as I just said, is no meat, no dairy, no wine, and oil. No meat and no dairy, pretty explanatory, pretty self-explanatory. We don't really need a lot of explanation on that. But a lot of people wonder about wine and oil. What does that really mean? Hold on to the end. It's okay. So wine. Does wine mean hard alcohol as well? You're going to find different answers from different regions and different priests. Now, this is my typical answer. We hear in the scriptures that wine strengthens man's heart. I mean, wine really does. When you're fasting, you'll notice that wine actually really strengthens you. Hard alcohol, not as much. Obviously, we want to stay away from drunkenness, no matter what. But if you find that hard alcohol is something that you really enjoy a lot, for instance, I love my scotch. You know that I really enjoy my scotch. And so during fast periods, I don't drink scotch because I just find that it's a little bit more of an enjoyment and more pleasurable than I typically would want during a fast period. And so if you find that that's a temptation for you, it's better to stay away from those things. The one exception I have is when we have company over. Sometimes I'll offer them a drink if that's kind of a hospitable thing to do. We'll talk more about that later on. So you can always discuss that with your spiritual father, which if you're coming to this parish would be me, and we can talk about kind of what balance to find there. Okay. As for oil, the fast specifically prohibits olive oil, and the reason for this is twofold. Okay. Number one, olive oil these fasting regulations were created in these Middle Eastern and Mediterranean countries where oil is more of a staple of the diet. I mean, you go to some of these countries, if you don't have bread and oil for a meal, they look at you like you're nuts. My wife's family in Romania, and Romanians are like this. If you don't have bread, it's not a meal. They just don't know what to do with that. They can't figure it out. And so typically what they'll do with bread is they'll dip it in oil. And then they'll eat it. And so it's more of a staple than it is here in America. But beyond that, oil, you'll notice, helps trap in a lot of the nutrients that you eat. And so when you eat with oil, you actually are more strengthened. When you don't eat with oil, you actually feel your body weaken quite a bit. I didn't know this until I was in college and I decided for the first time, you know what, I'm going to fast really strictly. I'm going to fast based on it's not even really that strict. It's how the church asks us to fast. My family had never done this. And so I decided, you know what, no meat, no dairy, but also no oil. I want to see what this is like. What it forced me to do was eat much more simply. You know, simple fruits, grains, nuts, steamed veggies. And you'll notice that during Lent, there's no oil allowed Monday through Friday, but Saturday and Sunday it's allowed. So I got through the first week of Lent, and by Friday I was sluggish. I was tired. I could feel it in my body. And on Saturday when I ate some oil, I started to strengthen again, and I got some more energy back. And I went, oh my goodness, the fathers really understood this a lot more than we give them credit for. Fasting kind of weakens the body. We'll talk about why that's important. It's not a masochistic thing where we're trying to harm ourselves. There's an important reason for this. But oil makes sense in that regard. So what do we do with other oils? It really depends. It kind of depends on where you are in the spiritual life. I try to stay away from most other oils. But at the same time, sometimes I'm doing like I'm doing now. You know, when I do fast periods, I typically do the keto diet. And so that requires a little bit of oil. And so I have a little bit of like an avocado oil or something with some things that I eat. But you need to find out where your strength is with that. Really, the goal is to just eat more simply. Eat really simple things, simple grains, breads, nuts, fruits, veggies. And you'll find that you're actually really blessed in the fast this way. And there's plenty of recipes out there to make fasting really good and tasty, but try to eat simply as much as you can. Most of us aren't there to begin with. We'll talk about that again in a little bit. But the whole point of this is, why these foods? One of the things people are surprised about is that when we say no meat, unless otherwise specified, it includes no fish. But you can eat shellfish. You can eat things that are invertebrates. You can eat shrimp and lobster. Like, well, this doesn't make any sense. Lobster is kind of a luxury here. First of all, it's lobster without butter, so who wants that? Nobody wants that. Come on. But beyond that, it's not just that these things were in abundance in, again, a Mediterranean setting. When you eat a burger and you go try to pray, you're going to notice that your attention is more distracted and you feel more sluggish. You feel weighed down. When you eat a plate of shrimp, not too many, of course, but when you eat shrimp, you don't feel so weighed down. So again, this is really about how the food affects the body. And so why is it that certain things like a clam or a mussel or these are allowed? It's because they don't really weigh you down and you're able to pray more freely. Okay? This is why these foods are chosen. Anything beyond this, beyond cutting out these certain foods, you should really receive a blessing for. If you want to go and only eat one meal a day, you should really seek a blessing for that. If you want to do, one of the typical things to do is the first 3 days of Lent. A lot of people won't eat or drink anything, or they just won't eat anything. They might drink something. A lot of people will try this, and it's fine, but get a blessing first. If it's your first Lent, I don't recommend it. I really don't recommend it. It's really a wise thing to do to wean yourself into fasting. We'll talk about how to do that in a minute. But you want to make sure you don't overdo it. So anything above and beyond what the church calls for based on what you see on the calendar, ask a blessing for and then see what's right to do. You also want to watch out for foods that may be technically fasting, but you don't want to eat a whole bunch of these things. And so, for instance, right now, I got it for the caffeine. I got myself a nice Diet Dr. Pepper. I'm not going to be drinking this every single day of the fast, and I'm not going to be subsisting off of Diet Dr. Pepper and gummy bears. Is it technically fasting? Yeah, but come on. that you really miss out on the spirit of the fast there. We should be eating healthy foods as much as possible. Now, every now and then, a little thing like, not a big deal. Not a big deal. But make sure that you're kind of aware of this. When I was young and stupid, now I'm older and stupid, whatever I am. I just said old and stupider. I didn't mean to say that, but it's probably true. When I was somewhat youngish, I went on a little bit of a road trip during Lent, and I packed, it was during a fast period, so I packed up my car, and I had potato chips and, gummy worms and soda, and so one of my friends looked in, he was Orthodox, and he goes, nice fast, and I went, yeah, he was right. He was absolutely right. I may have been technically fasting, but come on, could I pray really well, eating and drinking all that junk? No. So you want to watch out for that type of thing. One of the things that people also ask about is reading nutrition labels. There are some priests who will tell you that if you look at the nutrition label, you are being a Pharisee about fasting, don't do it. I disagree. I really disagree with that approach to it. I think it's perfectly fine to look at a nutrition label and look at what's actually in the food. I think that's fine. Because again, if these things kind of weigh us down and we want to avoid them, you want to avoid things that have milk and dairy and eggs and things like that inside of them. However, the way to avoid being a Pharisee is this. If you're looking at, let's say, two types of bagels, and one type of bagel is officially vegan, and the other type is not, but you look at the other one and eggs is like one of the last thing on the list, which means there's barely any egg in it whatsoever, and that cost you, $2.50 to buy that bag of bagels, and then the vegan ones, that's like $5, but they're technically vegan. my goodness, just get the regular bacon. There's not enough egg in there to affect you anyway. And there's really no point in trying to go that far with it and be kind of crazy about it. So look at the ingredients of the food. Find out. If it's really low on the list, it means there's barely any of it. Also, people worry. They say, oh, may contain traces of. Who cares? Who cares? It's not that big of a deal, okay? So don't go too far with this. But yes, look at the label. I do this all the time. There are times where I look at things that I think are vegan, and I find out, oh my goodness, milk or butter is like the second thing on there. Okay, I'm not going to eat that. I'm not going to eat that. There's nothing wrong with doing that. It's not being a Pharisee. That's just being cautious, you know, because we're not making that food. If you're making all your food, you don't need to worry so much about it. But because we don't, it's okay to look at the labels. Just don't go too far with it. You also want to watch out for, you know, overdoing it on, again, all the vegan stuff. There's so many vegan options out there. A lot of these grocery stores will now have vegan sections. It's great. They have vegan everything. They have vegan meat. They have vegan cheese. They have vegan mayo. They have vegan everything. But you're going to find that you spend like three times more doing that than if you buy regular food. What's the problem with that? Well, part of your fasting is eating less. And by eating less, you save money. And what do you do with that money? You tithe or give it an alms. That's part of your fasting. Part of your fasting is that you save money on food and you give it in alms. That's literally part of what fasting should do for us, is that the money we save on food, we give to those who don't have food. We eat in less abundance so other people can eat in more abundance, okay? So don't go too crazy with all the vegan options out there. Again, it's fine to have those things. I when I was in seminary, I tried to avoid them because I felt like I was cheating. Some of them were so good and they tasted so real. But I had a very holy priest. He goes, it may taste good, but it's not the same, is it? And I thought about it more and more. And I thought, you know, it's really not the same. Because, again, if I have like a regular taco with real meat in it, and then I have the vegan option doesn't make me feel so weighed down. Beyond that, we want to make sure that we eat, if we can, fewer meals. You know, the strict fast really called for. And by the way, canons, or as early as as soon as the church was legalized, we see canons having to do with the laity fasting. It was a normal thing for the laity to fast. And we know that they were fasting well before that. It was a normal thing. The earliest Christian communities that were ready to die at the drop of a hat, because that's what it meant to be a Christian, they held all their property in common. They lived as monastic communities, very ascetically. And they fasted a lot. So when the church was legalized, and now there's many more people and they're not as strictly dedicated, the church created, you know, more fasting rules. And the rules aren't seen as constraining, they're seen as freeness. Because when we fast, this is about freedom. It's about being freed from the constraints and the tyranny of the belly. We'll talk about the tyranny of the stomach in a minute. But anyway, one of the things that the early fasting regulations stated is that really, during these fast periods, ideally, we only eat one meal a day. Now, that's not something the church asks us all to do. We don't all have that strength, but it's a good goal to have. And so as you fast better and more, as you get used to it and you learn to love fasting, you can eat less meals. Again, ask for a blessing for it. It's a good idea to do that. But it's a good goal to shoot for. Even if we're not doing that, though, we want to make sure we never leave the table completely filled. Leaving the table a little bit hungry is part of your fasting as well. And so don't engorge yourself and say, well, it's fasting food, so it's okay. That's not the point. You want to leave a little bit hungry still. That's a good way to fast. Is this tough to get used to at first? Really tough, especially for Americans. Because we pile that food on, right? You know, if we go to a buffet, we like those words, right? All you can eat. How many times can I go back and forth? So we need to get used to this. We need to wean ourselves into it. One of the other things that people ask about is marital relations during fast periods. Is this something you want to avoid? The answer is very simple to this. If you and your spouse both have that desire and agree to it together, then by all means, abstain from marital relations. But if one spouse doesn't want to do that, the other spouse bows to them. It is not a requirement of the fast periods. And I will tell you, it's something that really, early on at least, you should ask, again, a blessing. I know it seems like a strange thing to ask a blessing for, but the reason I'm telling you this is very simple. There are some couples for whom trying to abstain from marital relations during fast periods is a bad idea. It's a really bad idea, and it's going to harm their relationship. they may have just, you know, been working through some things and they're just finally doing better. It'd be better if they just live as a normal married couple during that period, believe me. So there have been some couples who have asked for this blessing, and I've just outright told them, no, this is not for you, not right now. Maybe next year it will be, but for this year it's not. This is not a good idea, okay? Especially if a spouse feels neglected, really bad idea even to ask for it. Terrible idea. I've had husbands do this. I told the wife, you know, I really want to shoot for this. And the wife had been feeling so neglected for so long, and he knew this. It was terrible for her psyche. Or if she caught the husband, you know, looking at another woman or something like this. It was terrible for her to hear this. So husbands can be dumb. And every now and then you have to point that out to them. And I've had to do that with some couples and just say, that was really stupid of you. That was really, really dumb. You know, part of your self-denial is denying yourself this particular desire to abstain from these relations. This is not for you. You know, not this year, not this time. And so we need to watch out for those things. But if both members agree to it, again, probably good to ask for a blessing if it's early on. But after you've gotten used to it, you've been doing this for a while, it's perfectly fine for couples to abstain like that. And that's just an extra level of asceticism. It's an extra thing that you're abstaining from. It's good. It's not a bad thing to do. It doesn't mean relations are bad. It's not what I'm saying at all. They're blessed. However, it's also blessed, as St. Paul says, if you can, to abstain for a time. Okay, so I mentioned weaning yourself onto the fasting. Weaning yourself onto fasting doesn't take too long to do. But you want to make sure you don't want to hit fasting too hard too fast, because what you'll do is you'll make yourself sick. You will feel ill, and you're going to hate fasting. I want you to love fasting, which means you have to learn to love fasting, which means you need to kind of wade yourself into it. So how do you wean yourself into fasting? If you find that the fasting is just too much too quick, one of the things you can do is just cut out meat. Just cutting out meat leaves you with plenty of good options. You have lasagnas and pizzas and different things you can do on bagels and sandwiches and stuff. There's plenty of things you can still do. And so wean yourself off of meat Monday through Friday and try that for a week or two. Try that for a little while and then start cutting out dairy. By that point, you know, after you've done this for a couple weeks, you can cut out meat completely for the rest of the fast and then cut out dairy and try cutting out dairy just a few days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And after you get used to that for a week, then try Monday through Friday. And then by the last week, cut it out completely. Well, now you've just cut out by the last week meat and dairy. We can worry about wine and oil, you know, another time. Okay? So just wean yourself onto it little by little. And if you find it's too much, it's fine. Take a step back. But again, get advice. Get advice from me. Come talk to me, and we'll talk about what to do about that. Okay? One of the things that's really smart to do with this is also to plan your meals ahead of time. The reason this is good is very practical advice is because if you don't do that, you're going to get hungry and you're going to say, oh, I'm just too hungry. I can't do this. And you're just going to go for it and you're going to break the fast. And then you're going to decide psychologically, you're going to tell yourself, I just can't do this. Okay. And so plan out your meals ahead of time as much as possible and plan out good, healthy meals. Plan out good, nourishing meals. Again, gummy bears are not going to nourish you as much as I'd like to believe otherwise. Dr. Pepper, not going to nourish you. It may give you a little kick of caffeine, but that's about it. So, all this having said all this practical stuff, let's get to the meat of it. No pun intended. I didn't plan that one. What is fasting really about? We've talked a little bit about this already, but I think it's worth repeating. Fasting is about returning us to the proper ordering of life. The proper order of life is this. God is the top. Under that is our soul, which lives to serve God. And under that is the body, which lives to serve the soul. However, when Adam and Eve sinned, they took human nature and they flipped it. So that although it's unnatural to our intended state, it's natural to our fallen state. Our fallen state says the body gets the first say, and the soul is there to serve the body, and God gets the last place and maybe even isn't considered at all. This is how man is ordered today. Body, top, soul below that, God below that. Fasting rights the ship. It flips everything back. It says God gave the command to fast, then they shall fast. And I want my soul to be cared for before my body. So I'm going to force my body to care for my soul. How am I going to do that? I'm going to deny it the pleasure of food. I'm going to deny it that being weighed down by being satiated. And I'm going to make it serve the soul by going to prayer. Going to prayer in a state of self-denial and a state of service to the soul so that my soul can properly serve God. This is what happens when we fast. It actually reorders our lives and makes us properly ordered towards God. What this means is that fasting is always coupled with prayer. And so during these fast periods, it's a good idea to pray more. You may want to pray a little bit more than you think you can, because that's sustainable for 40 days. It may not be sustainable all the time, but for 40 days, you could probably pray a little bit more. And so we want to push ourselves during these periods to pray more with our fasting. And I promise you will find, I cannot explain to you why, I can only tell you that through experience, you'll find that prayer mixed with fasting is lighter, is more, is less distracted, and somehow it just feels more elevated than prayer without fasting. You'll notice this. And so this is one of the ways you'll learn to love fasting, is you'll learn to see that it actually really aids your prayer. It helps it. It gives your prayer wings, as we said. Fasting also helps to extinguish the passions, because when we weaken the flesh, we weaken the sinful passions that are embedded with the flesh. So what are some of the passions that might be embedded in the flesh? Lust is one of them. Fasting helps weaken lust. Anger. Fasting can really help weaken your anger. It's interesting that the world doesn't see it this way, right? That's what the Snickers commercials are all about, right? When people are hungry, they don't just get hungry, they get hangry. And they get really bitter. And if they just eat a Snickers, then life is good again. And they're happy. And it's just... No. Fasting actually mixed with prayer really helps decrease people's anger and irritability. Maybe not initially, but in time it starts to. And it doesn't take too long for that to happen. And so it starts to extinguish the passions of the body. We could talk about other ones, but just trust me in this. You'll notice this. It'll really help fight the passions. By the way, when somebody's struggling with a particular passion and they can't seem to get away from it, sometimes I will prescribe them extra fasting as a penance of sort. You know, penance for us is not a punishment. It's a medicine. This is a medicine for that particular passion. It's also an offering to God in obedience. When we fast, what we're doing is we're saying, I know that I become too worldly and too focused on the pleasures of this life. And so, in order to direct my life more towards God, I want to deny myself the pleasure of this life so that they don't become a distraction from God for me. And I want to focus more on God. One of the things you may have noticed that I haven't talked about is self-control. It's interesting. Every time Lent starts in the West, I'll turn on Catholic radio, and the first week they're always talking about fasting, and they always mention the same exact thing, that fasting is about self-control. That maybe there's an aspect of self-control there, but that's not really what it's about. And this is why in the Roman Catholic Church today, you'll see this idea of giving up something for Lent. And a lot of times it's really about this idea of self-control, but there's not this deeper idea of purifying yourself from the attachments of things to this life. I had a lot of friends, and even the Catholic bishops and priests will tell you don't do this, but they'll fast in college. They would fast from things that were sinful. And I thought, well, what's the point of fasting from things that are sinful if right when Easter comes, you're going to go right back to them? There's no point in that. There's no benefit in that. There's really no reason to do that. So it didn't make a lot of sense to do that. But a lot of times when people would give things up for Lent, you know, find something to give up, when I'd ask them what it's about, they'd say, well, this is about learning better self-control. Okay, but what's going to happen as soon as the fast is over? You're going to gorge yourself on these things. You're going to go right back to them and sometimes overdo it. And so fasting should have long-term effects. Now, again, we may not have the strength to carry that on completely with us, which is why the fast ends. But let's say we deepen our spiritual life by 5 points. Well, after the fast, maybe we only go up 4 points. Maybe we've learned to make some of that permanent, and we've learned to deepen our spiritual life a little bit. So that self-control is just an aspect to help us with a much deeper meaning here. And this is why the early Christians fasted so much. And again, fasted for 40 days before Lent, an early Christian practice. It's a very early Christian practice. It's one of the things that's kind of surprising about Christianity in the West today. They've done away with this. And they don't see the benefit of fasting because they don't fast. If they would fast, they'd see the benefit of it. But they took it away. Some other aspects of fasting. Fasting should be done in secret, just as Christ said. Christ said we don't walk around with long faces and, this is so tough, making sure everybody knows that we're fasting. We don't need to tell them. He says, go, wash your face and come out bright and joyful. So we don't need to tell people that we're fasting. We don't need to look sluggish. We want to avoid that as much as possible. We want to make sure that we're doing this with humility. If there's no humility, we're really harming ourselves with our fasting. We see this in the lives of many saints who either knew figures or sometimes they themselves did this early on in the spiritual life. They made the mistake of making a big show of their asceticism, and in doing so, they became very prideful. There was a story I read of a monk who he would leave his door open just a tiny crack so people could look in and see all the prostrations he was doing and the vigil he was keeping. And what he would do is whenever he heard somebody coming, he'd get up and start doing prostrations again. And, oh my goodness, this guy is so ascetic. And it was real saints who were living near him who treated him with such love and kindness that when he was eventually exposed, he realized, my goodness, I'm such a fraud. I'm such a fraud. And he went and repented and became a real monk. So we want to make sure we do these things in secret. One of the other questions we get a lot is, what about kids and fasting? Do we want the kids to fast the same way that we are? Depends on their age. When they're really young, I typically don't have my kids fast the same way that I do. They still eat dairy. They don't eat meat. We don't have meat during the fast. They can handle no meat, no problem. That's not a big deal. But you know, I'll order a cheeseless pizza. I know it sounds weird if you've never had this, where you get some extra sauce and some like veggie toppings on top. It's actually really good. I try not to do that too often because it's a little bit too good. But I'll get cheese pizza for the kids sometimes. But you know, as they get older, you know, 6, 7, 8, right around then we start taking off dairy most days for them. Most days, maybe not all of them, but you know, by the time they're like 9 or 10, yeah, they can fast with their parents. And if the parents fast with zeal and with love, and they show that they actually really love fasting, the kids will want to do it too. Same thing with prayer. If you show that you really love praying, your kids will want to pray with you. I don't know if I've told you the story in catechism, but I like to tell the story of Nectarius. When he was young, after a mom would put him to bed, he'd sneak out of bed and sneak past her room and run downstairs to my office where he knew I was praying, and he'd pray with me. And sometimes I'd be praying the Jesus prayer for a while, and you know, after 10, 15 minutes sometimes, I was surprised. You know, even at a very young age 3, 4, he'd sit with me for sometimes up to 20 minutes. And then he'd say, okay, I think I want to go to bed now. And I'd say, okay, I'd pat him on the head and he'd go off to bed. Sneaking out of bed, I try to discourage, but for prayer, no. That was great. That was really, really good. And so he actually learned to love to pray. And so now what happens is when we put our kids to bed, you know, Dometi goes to bed first. He's the youngest. And then my wife will put the girls to bed. And Nectarius, because he's in the same room as Dometi, he can't go in until Dometi is asleep. So he'll stay in our room. And sometimes when my wife is putting the girls to bed, I'll do some evening prayers. And he chooses now to get up and pray with me. I don't have to ask him. I never push him in it. But he chooses it. If he sees me, and he'll be playing with his action figures or whatever, and he'll see me and immediately put them down, jump up, and just stand right next to me and just pray. That's a good thing. It's the same thing will happen with fasting. The same thing will happen. If the kids see that you love fasting, they'll want to do it too. And if you talk to them about how we push ourselves and, you know, sometimes don't eat maybe for the whole day until sunset, and they'll kind of be inspired by that over time. And over time, they'll want to pray they'll want to fast as well. So know their strength, know their levels. Don't force it on a way in which it's a bitter thing for them, because you don't want them to learn to dislike fasting. You want them to learn to love fasting, and they'll learn that mainly by your example. And this is really the goal, is to learn to love fasting. In other words, fasting is not about what you can't eat. That's the big temptation, especially early on. Fasting is all about what I can't eat. I can't eat this, I can't eat that, and this is miserable. I'm going to go down the aisle at the grocery store and just think, can't eat that, can't eat that, can't eat that, can't eat that. This is terrible. No, fasting is about what you gain. And if you really are coupling it with greater prayer, you're going to find that you're gaining so much in the spiritual life that you're actually more filled. As your stomach is emptied, you feel more fulfilled. You feel like you're living out your purpose and meaning in life. You feel closer to Christ, and you're going to love it. You're going to find that it makes you feel freer. It's not a constraint. It's actually a push into true freedom, because the stomach is no longer the ruler. You make the stomach the slave of the soul. And that you have to do by force at first, but eventually it knows its place. And knowing its place, you actually find real freedom in the spiritual life, and you find real joys in fasting. So learn to love fasting as a gain, as a joy, as a freedom, not as something that's oppressive and not as what you can't eat. That's not what fasting is really about. Along with fasting from foods, you're also going to fast from certain sins. We should always fast from sins, but fasting gives us the strength to especially watch out for judgment, watch out for criticism, watch out for using foul language. We want to watch out for all these things and really try to avoid them as much as possible. Fasting helps us deepen our repentance. It's one of the main goals of fasting is to help us deepen our repentance. And you'll notice that as you fast more deeply and pray more deeply, your repentance deepens as well. This is what I've had a lot of people tell me, that in deep within, when they really push themselves for the first time, maybe they've been Orthodox for years, they decided, I'm really going to push myself in prayer and fasting to the point of constant discomfort, and they'll come and report something. You know what they report? For the first time, I prayed with tears. I wept in prayer. Tears is one of those gifts that we should ask for. Shouldn't ask for a lot of spiritual gifts, but tears is a good one to ask for. Are there exceptions to fasting? If you're ill, your body needs to be strengthened, you don't fast. If you have some sort of medication that you have to take before Holy Communion, ask for a blessing, I'll give you a blessing. Okay? If your medication is coffee because it helps wake you up, I'm not going to give you a blessing. It's not going to fly. I've had people literally ask me that. No, if you need a medication, that's fine. And if you need to take that medication with a little bit of food or a little bit of water, I understand if it's necessary. If it's not necessary, then we have to find out, okay, how important is it? For some people, it's really important. If I don't take this, it's not necessary, but I'm going to have a raging headache and I won't be able to even hear what's going on around. Oh, no, by all means, take your medicine. If I don't take this, I might feel a little bit of an itch on my arm. So, oh, all right, fine. Feel a little itch on your arm, you know. So we need to find out where that is. So just talk to me about that. It's very rare that I tell people, no, don't take that pill. In most cases, just take the pill. Okay. Also, if a woman is pregnant, now if a man is pregnant, we got a much bigger issue to talk about, and it's not going to fly. But if a woman is pregnant, the pregnancy is her fasting. That's a difficult thing for her body, and that is her fasting. If she's nursing, that also weakens the body quite a bit. It takes a lot more energy, and so we typically won't prescribe fasting. And I'll tell you, for those who have learned to love fasting, they want to fast even when they're pregnant or nursing. My wife, she will not go a Lent eating meat, even when pregnant. She refuses. And dairy, I have to push her for it. I'll tell her, you're really struggling. You need a little bit of something. But she hates going through these fast periods without really fasting, and so she finds that balance. And I tell her, you got to break it a little bit, but I understand you want to eat meat, that's fine. But you got to get a little extra protein here. We got to find something for you. And so you may still want to fast in some ways, but make sure, again, talk with me. Get a blessing for it. But for most people, the pregnancy is enough of an asceticism that you're not required to then. Okay? All right. So that's everything on fasting. Now, before I move on, just so we can go in topics here, questions that on the issue of fasting. No, Jeremy, you had a question.
One little thing I was going to mention is that I've been surprised to find that some people don't understand that poultry is also meat.
Yes. Jeremy mentions a good point. I had this happen once where a Lutheran family that my family was very close to growing up, they invited us over for dinner, my wife and myself, and it was Holy Week. And I said, well, we're fasting really strictly during Holy Week. We're not eating any meat, any dairy, wine, oil. I said, I really don't think you want us for a meal. And they said, no, just come. I mean, no meat. No. And this is her on the phone. She literally goes, she goes, no meat. I know, I'll make chicken. And I said, no, we can't have meat. She goes, chicken isn't meat. Chicken is poultry. No, poultry is meat. It's meat. So that, yes, that includes, it includes birds.
Fasting for the kids before church, when do you start? You're telling it's kind of hit and miss because the days that we wake him up super early and we get him here, he acts horrible on the altar.
Yeah.
Because he's hungry. So I don't know, like, when's a good time to start, like, easing him into it?
Yeah, okay, so the question is about kids and fasting before communion, not having any food or drink. So typically what I'll do is notice them in that period. Watch them in that young period where they seem to be able to handle it some weeks and not other weeks, okay? And you can kind of push it with them, but, you know, as you're driving to church, have a little snack in the car or something like that, so that if you notice it's just too much that week, give them a little something, okay? The other thing you can do is try just having them drink something, and they can drink something a little bit more hearty. You know, for instance, you can get like instant breakfast or something like that. You know, these kind of protein breakfasts and try that. But really, I mean, by the age of 6 or 7, it's usually pretty easy for them once they've had a little practice with it. That's what I've noticed. I know some priests who say at 8 is when they want to start that, but I've noticed by 6 or 7, almost any kid can do it. And so in that in-between period, it's okay to just test it week by week and see how they can do. Okay. Yes, Kier.
Yeah, Father, there's a lot of oil and food that we buy. So as long as we're not like pouring olive oil on our bread, it's okay. Like example, like the non-dairy spread for bread, like country crock or whatever, is that okay?
Yeah, so the question is about when there's oil in the foods that we're buying. You need to use a little bit of discretion in those areas. I don't like to set a hard and fast rule on those because I'll tell you it's a good idea to try to avoid anything with oil in it. I mean, I'm not going to discourage somebody from doing that. But if that's the only thing you can find and you need a little bit of something like that, then go ahead. It's not that big of a deal. But if we can avoid if we're going to try to avoid oil, I try to avoid it as much as I possibly can, you know, for whatever strength I have at that period. And so I don't like to set a hard and fast rule down, and that's a good example of something just to go and talk to me about, you know, privately, and just, you know, let me know the situation and what's happening.
Sure.
So it really depends on from person to person, and there's particular circumstances where, again, it may be more or less okay.
Basically, so. The less oil, the better.
Well, again, if it says no oil, try to do no oil. You know, that's really the goal. But if you can't do that, you know, doing less oil is better than more oil. Part of the reason I say come talk to me about it is because part of fasting is self-denial, you know, and so it's good to have somebody else make that. When I have anything, if there's any case where I'm going to break my fast, for instance, like I said, sometimes I have oil when I'm doing like a keto diet. If I don't, the keto diet becomes too much for the fasting, you know, but I always go and get a blessing for it. And if my priest says no, if my spiritual father says no, then the answer is no. You know, and I just and that blessing usually is enough of a strength. Believe it or not, it's a strange spiritual thing. But sometimes the blessing alone can strengthen us past what we think we're capable of. Okay, let's talk about being an ecclesial being. Ecclesial being. Ecclesial comes from the word for church, right? Ecclesia is the church, and so we want to be church persons, essentially. What does it mean to be a church person? It means that the church is meant to shape us. It's one of the lines you hear again and again, is that you don't come to change the church, you come to have the church change you. This is why we're here. Some people come into the church and they charge in and they can't wait to start making changes left and right because they know how things should be run. And that is the last person I want in any leadership position, really in a service position is what we should call them. These are the people that really need to learn that they need to focus first on their own heart and their own repentance. The church is here to change us. We don't fix the church. The church fixes us. And so we need to learn to be really quiet at first, being really quiet parishioners who just quietly live the spiritual life and learn to be shaped by it. Okay? The church, through Christ, is the repository of the virtues. And so that's what we're here to do, is to gain the virtues, to learn to really change. When people come in without that mindset, and again, they want to change things and improve things, they think they can improve things, it causes a lot of grief for the priests and the other parishioners, and it can really tear a community apart. I've seen this happen countless times. It's happened again and again and again. I know a priest right now who's dealing with this. He had a bunch of people move from one state to another, and they all came from the same parish, and they decided, you know what, the way we did this back home was way better, and so we're gonna go in all these positions, and we're gonna help you out, priest. We're gonna help you out, and we're gonna make all these changes. And guess what? It created a big schism in the church, so that they started to basically form cliques. There were the new people who wanted to go along with these new ways, and then there were the old people who said, no, we've been doing, like, you just came in, and you're now going to run everything for us, and it created a lot of interpersonal issues in the church. Well, it wasn't a good idea. They shouldn't have been allowed to even run anything to begin with. You need at least a little time, a good year at least, probably a couple years, of just quietly serving. It doesn't mean you can't, you know, help clean, can't help cook, can't cook. But directing things and trying to improve things, take a little step back and wait a little bit, unless you see something that's really a problem, okay? We'll talk about how to do that in a minute. But really, we want to make sure that we understand the church as a hospital for the sickness of sin, which means we are coming in as a patient, not as a doctor. Come in as a patient. Come as one who recognizes illness or recognizes that we don't see our own illness and we need to. We need a shift. We need to shift the idea of the church being a place where we go to the church being who we are. The church really should define us. It should become a defining aspect of our lives. We should not be satisfied with living in the world and going to church. It's not the way we want to live. We want to live in the church and happen to go to the world. We want the church to be the true home and the true place where we receive life. And we just happen to live in the world at this moment. Our true homeland is heaven. So, what are we? We're just sojourners. We're sojourners. But where do we learn to be true citizens of heaven? In the church. And that's where our main life is. You know, Christ said he wanted to come to bring life and life more abundantly. That more abundant life is found in the church. That means that we need to learn to have Christ-centered days. Christ-centered days. So that the church is constantly influencing our thoughts, our words, our actions. Every bit of how we live should be centered on Christ, and our minds should constantly be in the church. Father Josiah has this really nice image that he says of having a rubber band, a really large rubber band around the altar of the church, and then pulled out and wrapped around each parishioner, so that no matter where you go, you're constantly being pulled back to the altar of Christ. This is how our lives should feel, constantly being pulled back to the altar as much as possible. And this means that we're always focused on the meaning of life, the purpose of life, deepening our repentance, and what we gain in the spiritual life. Church cannot, again, be tacked on as just another thing that we're supposed to do. It should be the center of who we are and define how we live at work, how we live with our spouse, how we live with our kids, how we live with our friends, how we live day and night. No matter what we're doing, where we are, we should be ecclesial beings, church beings. And the church, the life of the church should really radiate out from our hearts. The more we live in the church, the more that happens because it gets kind of planted within us. You hear, I constantly tell you, don't just check off the boxes. That's living as a member of the world who happens to be an Orthodox Christian. Don't check off the boxes. Live with love for Christ. I'm not praying because I want to check off the box. I'm praying because I want to love Christ. I want to be with Christ. I want to live a life pleasing to Christ. I don't want to sorrow my Lord. And then if I happen to miss some prayers, I won't fall into despair. You just go, okay, I missed that prayer. I'm going to get right back up and go live a life pleasing to Christ. Because he's not happy with me wallowing on the ground, beating myself up. That sorrows him even more. He loves me. He wants to accept me as a loving father. This is how we really want to live. Okay, I'm going to skip just a couple things just because we are going to run out of time, but I'll talk a little bit more. So how do we act in the church? How do we act? What are the practical things we do? When we enter the church, we should make sure we enter with the sign of the cross. During Lent, you'll see people come in and they'll literally do three prostrations when they first enter the church with the prayer of St. Ephrem. You'll learn the same prayer of St. Ephrem when we get to Lent because you're going to hear it a lot. It's in the prayer book. It usually boxed off and it describes the prayer that should be done during Lent. Okay. When we come in, the first thing we do is we greet the saints, right? Remember, we talked last week about the icons and how the icons make the figure depicted really present before us. So we go and greet the saints. It doesn't matter what order you do this in. And a lot of people get really nervous about that when they first come to the church. Oh, I want to make sure I venerate the icons in the right order. Don't worry about that. Just come venerate the icons in whatever order and however you find best for you. Okay, my typical way of doing it is I'll do two prostrations with crosses, and then I'll kiss the icons in the groups that they're in. So I usually start on the right, that's St. Peter and Paul, and then St. Nicholas. And then I end with a third prostration. Then I go over to the left. It's just the way I do it. I do two prostrations with crosses, or two bows with crosses, and then I venerate St. Paisios, St. Basil of Ostrog is there, and then St. Seraphim of Sarov, and then my third bow. Then I go and do the same thing in front of St. Xenia, then the same thing in front of St. John. Then if there's a center icon, I do that, and then Christ in the Panagia. Okay? But you can do this however you want, but this is the first thing we do when we enter the church, greet the saints. If we're in the middle of a service, so long as the priest isn't giving the homily or reading the gospel, or there's not a procession going on, it's okay to walk up and venerate the icons in the front of the church. It's fine to do that, okay? There's freedom in the Orthodox worship. This is why we like not having pews, okay?
During Orthros, during the six songs, we're not supposed to.
Yeah, so during Orthros, at the very beginning of Orthros or Matins, there's six psalms that are prayed, and at that point, we neither venerate the icons nor do we do the sign of the cross. We actually stand in complete stillness. The reason for that is that those psalms are traditionally said to be the ones that will be read at the judgment. And so we stand as if in judgment at those six psalms, very still, very attentively. And when they're done, then we can start again doing the sign of the cross and venerate icons again. Okay? Okay. We make sure when we're in church, we're modestly dressed. Okay? We don't have a lot of like hard and fast rules and requirements here in the church. Like some women wear a head covering, some don't. It's okay. You know, some make sure they wear long dresses or skirts all the time, some wear pants. It's okay. It's not that big of a deal. You know, ideally, you know, women will wear long dresses or skirts, but you know, this is not like a hard and fast rule. We're going to make a big deal out of it. What we do want is modesty, and that goes for men and women. It means also that we don't wear things. For instance, my kids won't wear shoes with flashing lights. It's very distracting for people. Or shirts with all these, you know, images and stuff all over them. Okay, don't wear your, you know, Led Zeppelin 1970 something concert shirt with all the different places. Yes, Livy just said, "Dang it." Don't wear, you know, flaming skulls and everything. Don't wear a bunch of things with writing all over the place that will be really distracting for people, okay? So we want to make sure, at the very least, long pants and long sleeves for both men and women, and modestly dressed as much as possible. Also, don't wear lipstick or chapstick. If you have chapstick or lipstick on, make sure when you come into church, you dab it off. I don't like cleaning all the lipstick and chapstick off of the icons. We certainly don't want it on the communion spoon. Yes, I've had little bits of lipstick break off onto the spoon and then go into the chalice. And guess what? I or the deacons have to consume it at the end. We don't like to do that, so please don't make us do that. So it's also very disrespectful to the saints to leave lipstick marks and chapstick marks all over their icons. We want to be very cautious about these things, and so make sure we don't have those. I also really don't want your lipstick on my hands. Okay, I love you. I really do. I love all the people who come here. I don't want reminders of you when I look down at my hand and see red marks all over the place. Okay, so please don't wear these things. Just dab them off before you come. You may have lipstick that is like one of those no smear. What's it called? Indelible. Whatever. You know, it's not supposed to come off. I'll tell you, if there's enough of it on, it'll come off. Okay, it doesn't work perfectly, and so it's better just. Come into church very modestly, you know, without makeup. You know, that's the best way to go. Again, that goes for men and women. So, all right. The other thing is no food and drink in the church. Also, no gum. No gum. A lot of people will come in smacking their gum. Don't be smacking the gum in church, okay? Be still as much as you can so you're not a distraction to others. But also, there's freedom. There's freedom. This is why one of the reasons I love not having pews. There's freedom in the church. If you see your you know godparent or godchild, you know, a few steps down and you want to just go quietly greet them when they first come in, not that big of a deal. Or maybe you just have this urge. You just really need to go venerate St. Xenia in the middle of a service. Okay, as long as it's not distracting, but don't make a big habit of it. Try to keep kids with families as much as possible. Even if they love to see their godparents, they want to run over. No, go quietly over, give them a hug. Okay, that's great, and then go back. In the middle of some services, especially liturgy, it's better not to greet people when you come in. Okay? It's better just to come in and just stand and worship. And you know people come in at various times, and so we want to be cautious of that. But if you come in and it's an okay time, you know, no procession, no gospel reading at the time, go venerate the icons. That's fine. Okay, you can walk around, venerate the icons. Maybe you pass someone, tap them on the shoulder. Hey, good to see you. Boom, go on. Okay? So there's freedom within it. Embrace the discomfort. Yeah, there's discomfort in the services. Long standing, right? There's a little bit of discomfort, but there's something glorious about that. There's something really glorious because we're making an offering to God. We're making an offering to God with our very bodies. It's a living sacrifice. Just whatever you do, try not to be a distraction to others. It's the most important thing. That means when we do the Lord's Prayer, you know, don't hold your hands way up or put them on the side. Just keep your hands at your side, okay? You know, we don't do this. We don't do this, you know, with the hand up and the waving and stuff. That's a huge distraction to other people. It's just not a normal thing that we see in Orthodox churches. It never has been, okay? We want to make sure that we're not ostentatious in whatever we're doing, okay? So even making the sign of the cross. I've had people who making the sign of the cross, like it was like a big production and it became a distraction to other people, you know? Or there's Saint Porphyrius says, don't do the cross like you're playing the bouzouki. The bouzouki is like a Greek stringed instrument. You know, somebody goes like this, and if you're walking around the church doing that, that can be a distraction. We had one guy who used to walk around and he'd pray the Jesus prayer out loud in the middle of services. You guys know who I'm talking about, right? Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy. And Father Justin would have to turn around in the middle of service and say, be quiet, and he'd say his name. And so make sure, you know, you're just quiet, subdued, you know, quiet, still. We want other people to have this inner stillness as much as possible. Okay, so don't distract other people. Our services are Christ-centered, not us-centered. It's one of the things that is really different between Orthodox worship and a lot of other worship today. A lot of worship today is about entertaining us, making us feel good. No, this is about emptying ourselves out. So we want to make sure we're not a distraction from other people, but we also want to make sure that if it's Christ-centered, we're not focused on other people. If you notice other people who seem to be a distraction, especially if they're visitors, they don't know any better. So just treat them with love, focus as best you can, and if you can't focus, keep your head down, quietly just pray. Okay? So don't focus on other people. There's no point in correcting other people unless there's a real problem. Okay? Okay? If you see somebody come in and their skirt is riding way up and you can see the full moon, quietly go up to them, put your arm around them, say, my dear, I'm sorry, but I think your skirt's a little distracting to some people. Can we walk out? Maybe we can find you a wrap or something to put on. You know, you can be loving about it. But if something isn't too distracting, just pay attention to your service and pay attention to Christ, because that's why we're there. Okay? Repentance is our main goal, right? We're here for repentance, which means we're here for ourselves. Okay? We're here to deepen our own repentance and our own love for Christ and be in the hospital for the sickness of sin. So, this also means don't be a busybody, don't be a gossiper, and don't be a complainer. I can tell you, with this group here, I don't think I have that much to worry about. Okay? It's really good to have a group of catechumens where I don't think I need to worry about this. But this is a problem with a lot of people who come into the church where they become busybodies, gossipers, and complainers. We don't need to be doing these things. If you have a real issue, if you've tried to be humble about it, be quiet about it, you've tried to pray about it, but it's really nagging at you, or you notice something that's dangerous for other people or causing problems for other people, by all means, come talk to me about it. There are legitimate issues to come talk to me about. I'm not saying never bring up issues, okay? You may even have an issue with something I said or did. There may have been a simple misunderstanding. But if I get an email every single week about what I said wrong in my homily, I'm just going to delete them without looking at them after a while. So stop it, Livy, okay? Just kidding. So, again, there may be real issues, and if there's real issues, it's okay to come and bring them up. I'm not saying don't do that. I'm just saying don't make this a thing where you're constantly trying to correct those around you and constantly trying to improve things, and you think you know better than other people. If there's a problem, I'm going to point it out to you. I'm going to be blunt about it and tell you there's an issue with how we're approaching this. We need to just kind of step back a little bit, okay? All right. Okay, along with not being... not being a busybody, it doesn't mean that we don't want to be involved. We want to be involved in the church, which means we want to serve. If we're not serving, we become leeches, right? We go to the church where we want to get, but we don't want to give. We want to make sure we give. And that's through helping out with food, helping out with cleaning, helping out with setting things up. If there's any ministry that you feel like you can really help with, it's a fair thing to offer that, okay? It's a fair thing to offer. Don't insist on it, but offer it. You know, there are times when I have to look at somebody and say, I really appreciate the offer, but this is not your particular gift. We need to find some other way for you to help. Okay? For instance, a lot of people come to me and they want to be in the choir. Most people are really good about this, but I always give them the test. The test for the choir is this. Do this sound. And they go, and I go, and they say, and I say, okay, you passed the test. You can be in the choir. But some people, I go, do this. And they go, I say, okay, do this. And they go, And I say, this is not your gift. God has not blessed you with this particular gift. I really appreciate your fervor in wanting to serve the church. We need to find a different way for you to serve. Okay? So be humble. Be humble. Don't be upset if what you suggested or what you want isn't going to happen. Okay? You may be really helpful in your heart, but if you start insisting on it, this is no longer out of helpfulness. You've already gotten your answer. You know? And so this becomes a thing of pride. So just watch out for that. The church should be the central hub of our lives, but remember, the church is the people. We are the church. So that also means that the spirit of service we want to take with us to our homes. not everyone lives close to the church, and we can't all be here every time. I do services almost every day, and we do a lot of different teachings. Not everyone can be here for everything. And so make your homes little churches, which is what we're going to talk about in a minute, which means invite each other over, get to know people. As you want to get to know somebody better, and you say, you know, there's just not enough time during fellowship, then say, hey, would you like to come over for dinner? We need to do more of this type of thing. We need to get really close knit as a community. And this means doing this organically. Means being the church even when you leave in your home, okay? Along with being ecclesial beings, it means that we need to tithe. Tithing is part of your church life. Now, tithing typically means 10%. But the reason the church doesn't say 10%, like the Old Testament was very strict about 10%, the reason I will never ask to see your pay stubs, I don't want to know what you make, I don't want to know what you give to the church, is because for some people, 10% is just way too much. And for some people, 10% is way too little. It's way too little. Really, the goal is we want to give to the point where it hurts a little bit, yes. Because that is a real sacrifice. But we want to give to the church so that the church can continue functioning and ministering as it needs to minister. Okay, so tithing should be a part of our Christian life. But we want to tithe not just money, but also time and talents. Time and talents, which means offering to serve the church with everything we just talked about. Okay, we especially need people just constantly to stay clean. Eventually, I want to put a chart up where people can sign up for each Sunday. And we have like 2-3 families per Sunday that clean. And if everyone signed up for this, once a quarter, you'd have to stay and help clean after a Sunday. You know, so it's usually the same people again and again and again. We want to avoid that happening. You know, what's the ratio? What percent usually does? It's 20% usually does 80% of the work or something like that. That's pretty typical. It's pretty typical of church life. We want to make sure we avoid that. Okay. Being an ecclesial being also means looking for opportunities for worship. We do services all throughout the week, and we do teachings all throughout the week. So I tell people, try to find one service during the week and one teaching opportunity during the week to attend. And if that turns out to be too much, then alternate. 1 week a teaching opportunity, 1 week a service, 1 week a teaching opportunity. But find something where you can be involved at least a little bit every single week. Okay? I realize we do a lot of morning services. Not a lot of people can come to those. But Tuesday mornings, people can come to. But that may be too much for you. Saturdays. Saturday's liturgy should be really packed. Okay, Saturday morning liturgy, and I need to start talking about that more. But we had a really good crowd this morning. It's been a while, but we should really pack Saturday mornings because most people are off work. And that liturgy, I do that under an hour. And so and we always do memorial, so it's a really beautiful way to serve. But there's also other teaching opportunities. There's evening services as well, Wednesdays and Friday nights. Okay. In about 6 minutes, let's talk about the Church of the Home. The Church of the Home, St. John Chrysostom is the one who calls the home a little church. And this is what our home should be, a little church or even a little monastery in a way. Okay? This means that we should have prayer corners up. It doesn't need to be in a corner. It could be on a wall. But you should have a prayer corner. You should have a little section where you have an icon of Christ and the Theotokos, and then whatever saints you love, your patron saints, whatever. You should have a main one in your home where you and your family pray together, if your family can become Orthodox with you, and in the bedrooms of people who are Orthodox in the household. So in my house, we have a lot of prayer corners. There's one in the girls' room, one in the boys' room, one in mine and Lavinia's room. We have one at the entry of the house, and then one downstairs that's the main family one, and then one in the guest room. All over the place we have these, you know, every room. You don't need to have these actually covering your bathroom, you know. You don't need to do that. Some people like a little paper icon stuck to their mirror because it helps them to remember to pray when they walk in to brush their teeth. That's fine. That's fine. But, you know, you don't need to go crazy about it and have a gigantic icon wall in the bathroom or the closet. That doesn't really make any sense. You don't want to make guests uncomfortable when they have to go pee. I know a family that did that once, and the priest was the one who was uncomfortable. He walked in, and he goes, I couldn't go. There are like 30 icons on one wall. You're not going to do your normal praying. However, icons are not decorations per se. They're there for a meaning. But to have one icon adorning a room, it's fine. You know, if you have an icon in a hallway or going down the steps, it's good to have these things. St. Paisios talks about how just the presence of an icon brings a sense of peace and sanctity to a room that wasn't there before. So it's good to have icons really adorning all over our house if we can. As a family, we want to do morning and evening prayers together. We want to have the main family icon corner. It doesn't have to be there all the time. Sometimes my kids like to do it in their rooms. But we want to have that main place where we do morning and evening prayers together. Evening prayers, I really recommend doing them right before or right after dinner. And then, as people are going to bed, then you can have time for your personal prayers. And yes, you should have personal prayer outside of family prayer. Family prayer, a good idea is to do the little comp line we have in the parish prayer book. Or do an acathist or canon, something along those lines. But then on your own, as everyone's going to bed, and you want to teach your children to do that too, to have a little personal prayer time. Okay. We also want to pray before and after meals, and if you're homeschooling, before and after lessons. It's a good idea. In the prayer book, there's prayers for before and after meals and lessons. You'll find that in the back of the prayer book. So we want to make that a regular thing so that prayer is absolutely spotting the day. It's all over the place throughout our day. And the home becomes this absolute beacon of prayer, so that prayer saturates the day and saturates our lives. Okay? When we fast, and when we don't fast, we want to make sure we're eating healthy meals together. It's a good idea. Don't be eating out too much. Families should be eating together at the table. We should be having meals together as much as possible. It's really important for families to do this. Okay, so this means not having meals constantly in front of the TV or constantly on your own. This is not good for you. It's not good for your family. And it leads to a lot of secret eating. It leads to a lot of problems. And it leads to discord in the family. So we want to make sure we're eating together. Entertainment. Don't bring the devil into your home. Don't invite Christ through prayer and then invite the devil through a bunch of filthy movies and music. Avoid that stuff. It doesn't mean you can't watch movies together. You just want to make sure that the entertainment has some sort of good content and has some level of purity as much as possible. Okay? This may mean that there are certain movies you really like that you just have to fast forward through certain parts. Okay? But you want to pay attention to what you're bringing into your home as much as possible. And don't have music blaring. That's especially modern music is full of rhythms and words that are not befitting of a Christian. We want to make sure that if we're watching or listening to something, that we wouldn't, when the priest is over, we should remind ourselves, well, Christ is already here. Christ is here. And so make sure that you're not fighting against yourself in the spiritual life by bringing in entertainments that are not befitting of a Christian. You're just going to cause yourself problems. St. Cosmas Etelos had this saying, he prophesied the TV. You know what he said about the TV? He said, one day people will have a box in their living room which will invite the devil into their households. Pretty interesting description of the television. We want to make sure that our television watching is limited quite a bit. We want to limit it. We don't need TV on every single day. We certainly don't need it constantly. I know people who they say, oh, I just like it on those background noise. Well, then there's something wrong because you have trouble having silence and peace. So we need to make sure we walk away from that. Also, stay away as much as possible from these dangerous little things, phones and tablets. We don't want our kids having these things at all if possible. And if they do, just for a limited amount of time. And we want to make sure we're staying away from them as much as possible. We are addicted to our phones, and we need to really work on that. One of the things I want to sell in the bookstore is I want to start making people who do woodworking, I want them to have a little phone caddy with a hole in the bottom so you can plug it in, but it's like on a certain place in your home, you drill it into the wall, there's the phone caddy. When you walk into your house, boom, you put the phone in, plug it in, and you walk away and you just leave it there. I think that would be a great little invention that we could have that would really help us out rather than having the phone with us all the time. Vegging out with your phone on the couch, we want to avoid doing that type of thing, okay? We want to be really open with, if we have children, be really open with them about the spirit, have good spiritual conversations with them, teach them about the spiritual life and ask them when they're struggling. We want them to have an openness when they're really struggling with a certain sin and be able to come to the priest and talk to me about it. Okay? It's important to have that. So the kids shouldn't have constant closed doors and be on their own all the time. It's really dangerous, especially if you have devices that connect to the internet. You want to avoid that as much as possible. Make sure you're monitoring these devices, especially if they're doing them for school. I caught, I don't think he's upstairs, so he can't hear me, but I caught Nectarios the other day. I forgot that my wife has an iPad as well, and when I download something, it automatically downloads on that one, and I forgot about that. So I downloaded a Lego game for him, and I didn't realize it downloaded on that one. Well, guess what? One night, I walked in and I saw him quickly shift and I went, what was that? And I went, oh my goodness, the iPad's right next to him. So I opened it up and I looked at the last program used and sure enough, it was that. And so I had a little conversation with him about, being honest about these things, not hiding these things. And then I deleted it and told him, you're not supposed to play games without asking us first. And that's like once a week. So no more doing this. And he understood, but we want to be careful about these things. It's a good idea to learn church hymns. Learn the regular ones of liturgy, but also learn your patron saints' hymns. Learn hymns of major feasts and chant them together as a family during those major festal periods. You know, it's good when the kids are in church and they hear a hymn that they've sung at home a lot and they go, oh, I know this one. And their attention is, boom, immediately connected. Also with the saints in the walls, teach them about the saints in the walls. But don't tell them which one you're teaching them about. Teach them about the saint and then tell them, okay, on Sunday, I want you to tell me which saint we were talking about. I gave you some clues about what you'd see in their icon. See if you can find them. It's a good way to keep their attention really focused, and it makes the saints part of their lives. By the way, it's good for adults to do this too. Obviously, you can't do the game with yourself, but you can at least look up the saint and say, I don't know about this saint. I'm going to look this one up this week. Once a week, pick a saint and go learn about them. We want to make sure we direct everything back to Christ. There was a very holy nun who said this to my wife. She said, you know, don't just tell the kids clean your room, but tell them we need to clean the room because Christ gave us this beautiful home and we want to keep it clean for Christ. You know, why do we want to eat our dinner and not throw a fit? Because Christ gave us this food, not a thanksgiving to Christ. We want to do this for Christ. Point everything back to Christ again and again and again. Really good to do this, not only for the kids, but for us as well. Husbands and wives, learn to serve one another. If you're going to compete in anything, compete in humility. Who can serve each other best? Look for these opportunities and know when it's important to seek help. If you're having issues, come talk to me. Don't let the issues bubble over. Don't let them fester for long periods. If you notice issues coming up and you talk about it and you can't get past them, come talk to me. That's part of why I'm here. And we want to make sure we take care of these things before they become too major. Learn good Orthodox hospitality. Americans are not good with hospitality. Eastern Europeans are good. And I will tell you, I'm guilty of this. I'm terrible at this. My wife is great. When people come over, she makes sure there's a beautiful plate of food made. They are always offered constant drinks, constant food, whatever they need. There's a really beautiful thing about hosting people and having this good hospitality where you're constantly serving them as much as possible. Okay, finally, we want to make sure that our houses have a peaceful atmosphere about them. That means obviously making sure kids are well disciplined. I think, again, we don't have too much of an issue with that. A lot of the kids in the parish are very well disciplined and they learn that discipline. It's good. But we want to make sure that there's not chaos reigning, and that means being well disciplined ourselves. You know, it's the great Jordan Peterson advice: get up and make your bed. You know, make sure that we're keeping things clean and tidy. It doesn't need to be manic. We don't need to be crazy about this, right? We don't need to be like freaking out every time one thing is out of place. No, the house can look lived in, but we want to make sure that there's a certain cleanliness and order to it, because outward orderliness creates inward orderliness. So we want to make sure that we're good stewards of the gifts that God has given us, that we have peace. And there needs to be a good mix of freedom and formality, okay? So there's a certain formality to the way we live, but also that formality doesn't become so important that it ruins the peacefulness of the home and it takes over people's personalities, you know? The rules aren't more important than the people. The people are more important than the rules. But we want to make sure that there's a proper balance between the two of those. So there should be a mix of freedom and formality. Make God present in your homes constantly. Make him present through fasting, through prostrations, mainly through prayer. Through prayer, through good holy conversation, through scripture reading, through the reading of the lives of the saints. Should be normal conversation in an Orthodox household. Oh, I read the most amazing story in this life of a saint yesterday. Oh, tell me about it. Should be normal, you know, out of the blue. Oh, you know what? I feel like I've been kind of lazy today. I'm going to go do a canon or a kathos. Do you want to come join me? Sure. Normal conversation. This is how we should live. Okay. With a lot of joy, a lot of peace, a lot of love expressed in the household as much as possible. At the end of evening prayers, I forgot to mention, normal thing to do in an Orthodox household, everyone asks forgiveness of one another. We do this in my household. So after our evening prayers, the kids will then, you know, one by one, we all ask forgiveness of one another. Okay. And what's nice is on nights when we just couldn't do the evening prayers for whatever reason, my kids will say, oh, I forgot to ask forgiveness. And they'll run up to me and, oh, please forgive me, Dad. You know, and that's a really good thing. I see that kind of ingrained in them. Okay. It may be awkward at first because you've never done it. Fine. Awkwardness is not a reason to keep yourself from the kingdom. You want peace to reign in the household? Make this a normal part of it. Okay. Just as we ask Christ for forgiveness every evening, we ask one another for forgiveness of every evening. Okay. So that's the church of the home. So forgive me. We went over, so we really don't have time for a lot of questions. But if you have like one or two really quick questions, we can go ahead and ask. Yes, Kieran.
Yeah, a quick comment. I noticed you had a chapter on the email of the schedule from St. Thaddeus. And at the end it said we must practice abstinence That was in regards to the
fasting, yes,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. That's one of the books on the reading list is Our Thoughts Determine Our Lives, and it's one definitely you want to read that book. Okay. Anything else? Okay, forgive me for going over. We've got the great feast of the entry of the Theotokos tomorrow. So next week we'll talk about, again, the divine services, the end times and life after death. And as I mentioned, because it's the Saturday after Thanksgiving, if you don't come, it's fine. You have a blessing to not come if you want to just be with family that day. Obviously, if you come to Vespers, you really should. But that will be recorded, and I'll make sure it gets up. Just make sure you listen to it, because that's going to be an important one. The divine services, the end times and life after death. It's going to be an important talk. So thank you so much.